We ended chapter 4. We did chapter 5 with the whole adultery test. And then I just gave a quick intro to chapter 6. Okay? So if remember, we're going to be talking about the Nazarites, which was a special vow that you could take. And it was how a lay person, somebody not a priest, could dedicate themselves to the Lord. Okay? And in Scripture, there are some vague references to maybe some people were Nazarites. We think maybe Paul took a Nazarite vow in the New Testament. Okay, but there are three lifelong Nazarites that didn't have a choice. They were told they were going to be Nazarites before they were even born. So it's Samson. The angel tells his parents he's going to be a Nazarite. And then Samuel, Hannah vows to the Lord that if he gives her child would be a Nazarite. And John the Baptist. And John the Baptist, the angel, also tells his father that he will be a Nazarite. So we have three lifelong Nazarites, which is atypical. Okay. Typically, you took a vow for a period of time. And typically, you got to choose if you were going to be a Nazarite or not. But those three, Samson, Samuel, and John the Baptist, were lifelong Nazarites, and they had no choice in the matter.
I don't think so.
No. No, but no, it says razor, so no, I don't think they were.
Well,
so
that's how Samson uses his powers,
right,
cuts it.
Right. So think of how long your hair would be if you were to let your hair grow, never cut it your entire life.
Long.
It's long. I mean, I'm sure they must have bound it up some ways, or it would have been a disaster. But yeah.
I've seen movies. Of
think Rapunzel. No. Yeah. Right.
I don't know if that's
I suppose. Yeah. So, yeah. So, and remember we talked about how Samuel anoints David and John the Baptist prepares the way for Christ, right? And Christ and David are parallels. David is a type of Christ. So those two are kingmakers, okay? And then Samson exists to serve as everything that this Nazarite vow is not to be. Samson is the one you don't want to follow when you take the Nazarite vow. Okay? So that's what we talked about last week. So this week we will get into chapter 6 itself. And again, this is more just the mechanics of how the Nazarite vow worked. It doesn't even say really what they did, what their vow contained, like what they were supposed to do in the service of the Lord. It's just the rules around it, what happens if you accidentally break it, and how to end it. Is what chapter 6 is.
I always thought when it was Samuel and his mother said he'll be put in the Lord to serve God.
Yes.
I always thought it just meant that he would be in the temple.
The tabernacle, yep.
Or the tabernacle.
Right.
His whole life, not that he would.
Right, but if you look at 1 Samuel 1:11, the very end of it, it said, and a razor shall never come on his head. And so then that's how you know.
Okay.
So yes, I mean, when this story is usually taught in Sunday school or growing up, they don't ever point that part out.
No.
It's, yes, he just went to the tabernacle with Eli, you know, and helped serve the Lord that way. But that's the key, is that when she is praying, right, she says, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and a razor shall not touch his head. So it was more than just giving him to the service of the tabernacle. He was going to be a Nazarite.
He left a really long time.
Yeah, so he had really long hair. Right, right. But he was promised to the Lord as a Nazarite before he was even conceived. I mean, Hannah wasn't even pregnant at that point. So, yep. All right, can someone read for me verses 1 to 21 of Numbers 6?
And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the people of Israel and say to them, when either a man or a woman makes a special vow, the vow of a Nazarite, to separate himself to the Lord, he shall separate himself from wine and strong drink. He shall drink no vinegar made from wine or strong drink, and shall not drink any juice of grapes or eat grapes, fresh or dried. All the days of his separation he shall eat nothing that is produced by the grapevine, not even the seeds or the skins. All the days of his vow of separation, no razor shall touch his head. Until the time is completed for which he separates himself to the Lord, he shall be holy. He shall let the locks of his hair of his head grow long. All the days that he separates himself to the Lord, he shall not go near a dead body, not even for his father or for his mother or for his brother or his sister. If they die, shall he make himself unclean, because his separation to God is on his head. All the days of his separation, he is holy to the Lord. And if any man dies very suddenly beside him, and he defiles his consecrated head, then he shall shave his head on the day of his cleansing, and on the seventh day he shall shave it. On the eighth day he shall bring two turtle doves or two pigeons to the priest, to the entrance of the tent of meeting. And the priest shall offer one for a sin offering and the other for a burnt offering, and make atonement for him, because he sinned by reason of the dead body, and he shall consecrate his head that same day, and separate himself to the Lord for the days of his separation, and bring a male lamb a year old for a guilt offering. But the previous period shall be void, because his separation was defiled. And this is the law for the Nazarite. When the time of his separation has been completed, he shall be brought to the entrance of the tent of meeting, and he shall bring his gift to the Lord, one male lamb a year old without blemish for a burnt offering, and one ewe lamb a year old without blemish for as a sin offering, and one ram without blemish as a peace offering, and a basket of unleavened bread, loaves of fine flour mixed with oil, and unleavened wafers smeared with oil, and their grain offering and their drink offerings. And the priest shall bring them before the Lord, and offer his sin offering and his burnt offering. And he shall offer the ram as a sacrifice of peace offering to the Lord, and with the basket of unleavened bread. The priest shall offer also its grain offering and its drink offering. And the Nazarite shall shave his consecrated head at the entrance of the tent of meeting, and shall take the hair from his consecrated head and put it on the fire that is under the sacrifice of the peace offering. And the priest shall take the shoulder of the ram when it is boiled, and one unleavened loaf out of the basket, and one unleavened wafer, and shall put them on the hands of the Nazarite, after he has shaved the hair of his consecration. And the priest shall wave them for a wave offering before the Lord. They are a holy portion for the priest, together with the breast that is waved and the thigh that is contributed, and after that the Nazarite may drink wine. This is the law of the Nazarite. But if he vows an offering to the Lord above his Nazarite vow as he can afford, in exact accordance with the vow that he takes, then he shall do in addition to the law of the Nazarite.
Okay, so that's the law of the Nazarite. Okay, so let's just take it bit by bit. So at the beginning, verse 1, again the Lord spoke to Moses. Okay, so this is direct revelation from God. And God is the one that created this vow and made all the rules for this vow. Okay? So we talked about last time, God institutes an entire office to show the nature of dedication. That it is total, and it changes your life when you are dedicated to God. Okay? Notice, verse 2, this vow is for women as well. Now, I don't believe we have an example of a woman taking this vow in Scripture, but it says when a man or woman. Okay, so a woman could never be a priest, right? And really, only the Levite sons of Aaron could be priests, right? So it was very restricted. But a woman could make a Nazarite vow and be dedicated to the Lord this way. So it's open to men and women. There was one commentary that said that they thought, because a woman has long hair anyway, right? So how do you know if she's a Nazarite? That she would wear her hair unbound, not up, if she was a Nazarite. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what they said. Is a possibility for how a woman would be identified as a Nazarite. Because the man, the long hair, I mean, after a while would become obvious, you know, that he's a Nazarite. And a woman might have worn her hair down if she was a Nazarite. Okay? So this is a way a woman could dedicate her at least a period of time to the Lord. The word Nazarite is just a transliteration. It's not a translation. So transliteration means they just took the Hebrew word Nazir and made it sound English. Okay? Nazarite. All right? So Nazir in Hebrew means to be set apart. So this is really the set apart vow. The Nazarite vow is really the set apart vow, how you would set yourself apart for the service of the Lord. Okay? Just like, I don't know if you know, baptism is also a transliterated word from baptizo. Okay, so they just make the Greek word sound English. It's not a translation. Okay, so they were set apart to the Lord. Verses 3 through 8 tell us all the rules. Okay, not necessarily what the vow entails, but all the things that the Nazirite cannot do. There are three of them. Okay, so basically one is no products of grape. No part of the grape at all. Okay, which includes alcohol and any strong drink. So I suppose, I don't know if they made beer out of grain. I don't know. Okay, but strong drink, alcohol, and most often the alcohol was wine, if not all the time, out of the grape.
I have a note on beer versus wine.
Yeah. Yes.
Consuming wine during their time of ritual service. The vineyard denoted a sedentary lifestyle that often lost its perspective of total devotion to the Lord. And it says, see Jeremiah, different spots in 55. Beer translates a Hebrew term traditionally translated strong drink, derived from the verb shakar, to be drunk. The distillation process, which leads to higher alcoholic content than can be achieved via mere fermentation, was unknown until the 9th century A.D., thus, the ancients were unable to make beverages that were as potent as the strong drinks that had been available since medieval times.
Yes.
This is why HGSB translators reason that beer is more accurate.
Okay. Okay, well, it says, right, it says wine and strong drink. So then any sort of beer they could make. They were not to have alcohol at all, which a lot of times they would add wine to their water to cleanse it.
Yeah.
You know, so just to make it drinkable. So I guess the Nazirites just had to boil their water or something to clean it to drink. But they were to not to have any products of drinks and no wine or alcohol. They were not allowed to cut their hair. Okay. Verse 5, no razor shall pass over his head. Okay. And then 3, you are not to be unclean because of a dead person. Okay. It didn't matter who died. It doesn't matter if it's your father, if it's your mother, if it's your brother, your closest relative, doesn't matter. You cannot attend the funeral. You cannot be with them, okay, because that will make you unclean. Now, notice, these are, verse 5, all the days of his vow of separation, okay? So, except for Samson, Samuel, and John the Baptist, you would take a vow for a certain period of time. I don't know how long was the average, okay? A year, 5 years. I don't know if they would take it in terms of months, you know, 6 months. I'm not sure what they did. But there was a time when it began and there was a time when it ended. So when you take the vow, you wouldn't know how this third restriction would affect you because you don't know if somebody close to you is going to die, you know. So it might have been not a big deal at all because you take a vow for 3 years and nobody close to you dies and so you're fine. Or, you know, you could take a vow for 6 months and both your mom and your dad die. You know, you don't know. And so then it could be a bigger deal. But when you take the vow, you are not to be with a dead person at all.
What about when they go to war?
Well, they wouldn't be able to go to war, I would assume, because they cannot be with the dead people.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Samuel went and lived in the temple, didn't he?
Oh, and Samuel hacked Agag to pieces. What about that?
Yeah.
I just thought of that. Yeah. When Saul doesn't obey. I'll have to ask Kyle.
Because I was thinking, so...
Sorry, what was your question? I just thought when you said Samuel that I thought that.
No, that's fine.
I'll have to ask Kyle.
He lived there. So when, if you lived your whole life, did you live in the tabernacle your whole life? Or was that necessarily part of the vow?
No, that was not necessarily part of the vow.
Okay.
Because John the Baptist certainly wasn't in the temple. He was out in the desert.
Right.
And Samson wasn't.
Right.
Oh, man, I have to ask Kyle about Samuel.
Didn't God order him to do that, though?
God ordered Saul to do it, and Saul didn't. He disobeyed. And so then Samuel came and did it because Agag then thought he was going to be spared and was all confident. And so then he comes out, and Samuel kills him. Pretty sure it says Samuel hacked Agag to pieces. I mean, It's in Samuel. I will ask Kyle about that and follow up. I mean, I don't know, but maybe it was because it was command. God, I'm sure, commanded Samuel to go confront Saul, and so maybe that is the reason why. But anyways, yeah. Okay.
Maybe the angel of the Lord took over Samuel.
Okay. All right, so like Marian said, these restrictions are stricter than for an ordinary priest. And the third, the dead, that's more akin to the high priest. Okay, if you remember in Leviticus 10 with Nadab and Abihu, right, it says then that the priests could go and mourn the death of a close loved one, but Aaron was not allowed to. Okay, because he was high priest. Okay. And Leviticus 10:9 says that priests have to abstain from alcohol before serving in the tabernacle. Okay, when it's only Eleazar and Ithamar, then I'm sure that's almost all the time, right? But later on, when there are a lot more priests and you would take a rotation in the tabernacle, then you were only to not drink alcohol right before you served, right? So, because obviously you don't want to serve the Lord drunk, because that's maybe what Nadab and Abihu did, and they got zapped for it. So they were allowed to drink alcohol at other times, but not right before they served tabernacle. So the Nazirite was more strict, okay? And then, again, it was their long hair that probably made them stand out the most.
It's just so funny with the grapes that he's so particular about making everything. Not even the seeds or the skins.
I know. What do you make with the skin of a grape?
Hey, so you would try to ferment that.
Yes.
It's outside of the Nazir vows, or any other rules for Israel not to cut their hair?
It says the men are not to cut the corners of their hair. That's why the Orthodox Jews have their little curlicues. Mm. So what exactly that meant, I'm not 100% sure, but that's the way at least the Orthodox Jews interpret it. So they will have, men will have short hair, but I'm sure you've seen them. Have you seen an Orthodox Jew? Yeah, they have on the corners of their hair, so literally right here, they grow this part long, and then they'll curl it. So they will have curl. So they'll have short hair, and then they'll just have their curls. But men were to have short hair. Okay, and in the New Testament, it says that too, and women were to have long hair. So, so that's what would make the Nazirite man really stand out, because he would have long hair and every other man has short hair. Even if they had the curlicues, they'd still basically have short hair. Okay. Okay, so verses 9 to 12 tell us what happens, what you have to do if you accidentally defile yourself because of a dead person. So somebody falls dead on you or next to you, and you can't do anything about it, right? So the idea is the third one, right, the dead people thing, maybe you could violate by accident. But the grapes and the hair, those were never to be violated by accident, right? Samson is stupid, right? Keeps going back to Delilah, and that's how he loses his hair, you know. But that is his fault for continuing to return to Delilah. Okay? So let's go to Numbers 19. Can someone read Numbers 19, verse 11 and 12 for me? Numbers 19, verse 11 and 12.
Uncleanness with the water on the third day and on the seventh day, and then he will be clean. But if he does not purify himself on the third day and on the seventh day, he will not be clean.
Okay, so we get rules on, because touching a dead person always made you unclean. Okay, and remember, eventually we're going to be wandering 40 years in the desert, and there's going to be a lot of dead people. Okay, because that entire first generation has to die off. So God gives rules of what you do when you touch a dead person. Okay, so for the normal Joe Schmo, you were to be you would be unclean for a week. You would wash yourself with special water that the beginning of 19 talks about. We'll get there when we get there. Okay, but you would wash yourself on the third day and the seventh day, and you were done. Okay, so that's how your normal person would become clean after touching a dead person. For the Nazirite, it was much more complicated. Okay, I assume that they would still wash on the third day and the seventh day because that's what everyone has to do. But the instructions really start in end of verse 9 on the seventh day. Okay, verse 9, but if a man dies very suddenly beside him and he defiles his dedicated head of hair, then he shall shave his head on the day he becomes clean. He shall shave it on the seventh day. So he washes on the third day, he washes on the seventh day, and now technically he's clean, but because he's a Nazirite, now he has all these steps that he has to do. Okay, so step number 1 is you have to shave your head. Okay, so on the seventh day. So on the day you become clean, you have to shave your head. Then on the eighth day, which is just the next day, okay, verse 10, you have to bring sacrifice, a sin and a burnt offering. Now you're allowed to bring the doves or the pigeons, which are the poor man's sacrifice. Okay, so, and it says the priest shall offer one for a sin offering and one for a burnt offering. Okay, so that's next. So you have to bring sacrifice. If you were a Joe Schmo and you touch a dead person, you don't have to bring sacrifice in order to become clean. You just have to wash. Okay, so the Nazirite now has to shave his head and he has to offer a burnt offering and a sin offering. Then he has to rededicate his head, right, to the Lord. Yes, this is all on the eighth day. End of verse 11, and that same day he shall consecrate his head and shall dedicate to the Lord his days as a Nazirite. And shall bring a male lamb a year old for a guilt offering. So now not only does he have to bring a sin offering and a burnt offering, he has to bring a guilt offering because he has violated this vow to the Lord. So he owes the Lord something. Okay, and then end of 12, but the former days will be void because of his separation will defiled. So he has to start his Nazirite vow all over again. So let's say you made a Nazirite vow for 2 years, and 6 months in, somebody dies next to you. Well, you got to start your 2 years all over again. There was a story, I'm not sure if it's true. Some queen made a Nazirite vow for 7 years, and somebody died next to her, like on year 6 or something, and she says she had to start all over again. Okay. Okay, and we're going to see that when they finish their Nazirite vow, they shave their head as well, but then they burn their hair as an offering to the Lord. If a dead person dies next, or if a person dies next to you, you do not offer your hair because your head of hair, your holy hair, has been defiled. Okay, so you just shave it and get rid of it. You don't burn it to the Lord.
That must have really stunk if they did burn it.
Oh. Yeah, well. Later on, yep. Okay, so violating the Nazirite vow was a big deal. Okay, now God allows for accidental if somebody dies next to you, but you still have to go through all these steps and start your vow all over again. Okay, so making a Nazirite vow was serious. It was a big deal. There were things you couldn't do. You were dedicating yourself to the Lord. And the idea is that dedication to the Lord should drastically change your life and is a very big deal. Okay, and it's not something to be taken lightly, and it's not something you can just do now and do then, quit when you want, and do whatever. Okay, it was a big deal. Okay, 13 through 20 talks about completion of the vow. Okay, so when your time is up, when you have served your time and your vow is over, and this is when what we think maybe Paul was doing when he came back to Jerusalem for the fulfillment of his vow. Okay, this is what he would have done if it really was a Nazirite vow that he took, which we think it was. Okay, so verse 13, he's supposed to bring an offering, and this is the offering he's supposed to offer. It says all these animals, and then at the end of 15, it says along with their grain offering and drink offering. Okay, so it's not super specific, so I'll let you know what goes along with it. So for the burnt offering, they were to bring a 1-year-old male lamb. Okay, and then with the grain offering and the drink offering. So that would have been 1/10 of an ephah of grain and 1/4 a hin of wine. Okay. Then for the sin, this would be a 1-year-old ewe lamb, so the female lamb. And then the same. Okay, 1/10 of ephah a grain and 1/4 a hin of wine. Oh, and 1/4 a hin of oil. I forgot that. Okay, and then the same here. And then for the peace offering, they were to bring a ram, 2/10 of an ephah of grain, 1/3 a hin of oil, and 1/3 a hin of wine. Okay, and if you remember, the peace offering, this is the one that they got to eat, too. Okay, so this was probably the wine that they got to drink. And this would be the one that they shared with their friends and their family. Okay, and they were also to bring a basket of unleavened cakes and wafers that would have been part of this peace offering, which part of it would have been offered to the Lord, and then part of it, it would have been the meal that they would have eaten. Okay? So in this case, verse 16, then the priest shall present them before the Lord and shall offer his sin offering and the burnt offering. He shall also offer the ram for sacrifice of peace offerings. Verse 18, the Nazarite shall then shave his head, his dedicated head of hair at the doorway of the tent of meeting, and take the dedicated hair of his head and put it on the fire, which is under the sacrifice of peace offerings, okay? So he burns his hair during this offering, during the peace offering. Okay, so his hair was part of the sacrifice, all the sacrifices that are offered to the Lord. Because the hair is the sign of the vow, and so then that's why his hair is holy. No, it says shave his dedicated head of hair. Okay, verse 19, it says the priest shall take the ram's shoulder when it has been boiled. This is part of the peace offering. And 1 unleavened cake out of the basket and 1 unleavened wafer and shall put them in the hands of the Nazarite after he has shaved his dedicated hair. Then the priest shall wave them for a wave offering. It is holy for the priest, together with the breast offered by the waving. So if you remember from our sacrifices in Leviticus, of the peace offering, the priest usually got the breast and the thigh, one of the thighs, okay? Here he also gets the shoulder as well. So for the Nazarite vow, the priest gets more of a portion of the ram than is typical. And then more likely than not, the Nazarite's friends and family would join in with him in eating the peace offering when it is fulfilled, right? And it says afterward, the Nazarite may drink wine. So during the peace offering, during that meal, he could have the wine that he had brought. Okay. Verse 21 is just the conclusion. It says, this is the law of the Nazarite who vows his offering to the Lord according to his separation in addition to what else he can afford according to his vow which he takes, so he shall do according to the law of his separation. So this was the bare minimum of what you were to bring or to offer to the Lord. If you had said, I will also give this whatever to the Lord as part of your vow, and it says according to your means, okay? In addition to what else he can afford. So according to what you could afford, if you were wealthy, you might have said, I will pay the Lord this much. And then that money would be given to the tabernacle, okay? Or I will bring a bull, you know, or whatever it was. So this was the bare minimum of what a Nazarite vow entailed. And if you were able to afford more and that was part of your vow, then you also had to fulfill all that before your vow could be complete and you were done. Questions, the Nazarites. Okay. Can someone read for me verse 22 to 27?
will say to them, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine on you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance on you and give you peace. So they shall invoke my name on the sons of Israel, and I then will bless them.
Okay, so this is the Aaronic blessing. Okay, the question is, why is it included here after the Nazarite vow? It's a reminder that all of Israel is blessed, not just the Nazarites, right? But all Israel is to be holy, and holiness leads to blessing. Okay? This blessing has been written out and found in many archaeological digs. Okay? Pieces of it or fragments of it or whatever. It's been found in many of them. Okay? So we know that this was a very important blessing to Israel. The priests would say this blessing at the end of the morning service in the temple and later in the synagogues all throughout Israel. At the end of morning service, they would say this blessing. Okay? So if you notice, the 24, 25, and 26 are the blessing, and each one starts with the Lord, each verse. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you. The Lord lift up his countenance. Okay? So three times it's about Yah, and notice Lord is all capitalized, so that means it's Yahweh, the covenant name of God. So this emphasizes that God is the source of all of Israel's blessing. Okay, each line starts with the Lord and is followed by two verbs. Okay, bless and keep, make his face shine, be gracious. Okay, lift up his countenance, give you peace. And the second one is expounding on the first one. Second verb expounding on the first verb. Okay, so the first phrase, the Lord bless you and keep you. Okay, holiness leads to blessing. Okay, right? We're emphasizing God's holiness in all of this, even the Nazarite vow, right? This is what it looks like to be holy to God. So holiness leads to blessing. And blessing in the Old Testament is specifically children, right? The promised land, property, protection from enemies, and God's presence. Okay, I mean, a lot of it's part of the Abrahamic covenant, right? That you will multiply, I'll give you land. You know, you're going to own land. God will be with you, okay? Protection from your enemies. So Israel has already experienced God's deliverance from Egypt and his protection and provision in the wilderness, right? He's protected them and provided them manna and water when they need it. Okay, can someone read for me Psalm 67, 1 and 2? Psalm 67, verse 1 and 2.
May God be gracious to us and bless us and make his face shine upon us, that your way may be known on earth, your saving power among all nations.
Okay, so it says, right? God be gracious and bless us. Okay? So God's blessing is directly equated with salvation among all the nations. So when Israel is blessed, when Israel is truly blessed, it is a blessing to the nations and will bring salvation to the nations. When Israel is obedient and functions as they are supposed to, as an example of who God is and his purpose for the world, it will bring blessing to the nations, salvation to the nations. Okay, and this is part of Genesis 12, right, when God says that through you, Abraham, all the nations of the world will be blessed. Okay, so when Israel is blessed, the nations are blessed. Okay, the second phrase, the Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. Okay, so this is holiness leads to a full relationship between God and man with fullness of benefits. Yes. Yes, it's very common. Yes. It might be. It might be. Yes, evangelical churches or Christian churches, they will use this blessing. Yes. Yep. So God making his face shine upon you is kind of equivalent to God smiling at his people. Okay? Can someone else read for me Psalm 80, verse 3, and then verse 7? Psalm 80, verse 3, and then verse 7. Psalm 80, verse 3, and then verse 7.
Restore us, O God, let your face shine, that we may be saved. Restore us, O God of hosts, let your face shine, that we may be saved.
Okay, so God's face shining on Israel is equated with salvation. Okay, when God is favorable, has a favorable, you know, smiling at Israel, making his face shine on Israel, it's equated with salvation. Okay? And he will be gracious, right, to you. So he will be, when he is pleased with you, he will be gracious to you. Verse 26, the Lord lift up his countenance on you and give you peace. God pays attention to his people, lavishes them with his favor, and that brings peace. Okay, and Kyle talked about this on Sunday. Peace is a state of rest and wholeness, right? It is not just absence of conflict. Conflict, it is the presence of God. That's what it is. Okay, this is a peace beyond human comprehension. And it's only available through the favor of God. Okay, can we? Someone read for me John 14, 27, which I believe we read this week. Yes, we did. John 14, 27. This is what Kyle preached on Sunday.
Peace I leave with you, my peace I give to you. Not as the world gives do I give to you. Let not your hearts be troubled, neither let them be afraid.
Okay, so ultimate peace with God comes through Christ, right? And it's through Christ, and Kyle talked about this on Sunday, the disciples should have been excited that Jesus was going, right? Because it was through Jesus' death, resurrection, and ascension that they could have ultimate peace with God, right? They didn't get it, which makes sense, but ultimate peace comes through Christ. Okay, so holiness matters, and Israel was to be proclaiming this to the world. No, they never really did a very good job of it, but that's what they were supposed to do. And they were to show the world that true peace with God comes through holiness, comes through a right relationship with God. And when you have a right relationship with God, you don't get to just live any way you want to, right? You are going to live in obedience, and you are going to do what's right. Verse 27, so they shall invoke my name on the sons of Israel, and I then will bless them. That word invoke can also be translated put. So it can read, so they shall put my name on the sons of Israel, right? So God's name is on them, meaning they will be identified with God. People should look at Israel and see God, okay, because God's name is on them. The whole blessing is a reminder to Israel of their relationship with God and how they are to live. Okay, so here, Israel is faithful and obedient and will receive God's blessing. God is gracious to them even in their disobedience, but his full blessing only comes through covenant obedience. Okay, because we know they don't stay here. Right? First 10 chapters, they do great. After that, they don't. Okay, so here, they're doing great. And God's blessing is on them, but they are going to disobey. And God is so patient with them. My goodness. He is so patient with them. This is what, 1445-ish AD, 1444 maybe, okay? They don't go into exile until 712 and 566, I believe, right? Something like that, 5-something or 86, something like that. Anyways, like almost 1,000 years later. Not quite, but, you know, 700 years at least for Israel, God puts up with them, the northern kingdom. So God is very patient with them in their rebellion. All right, questions. Chapter 6. All right, chapter 7. This is what I thought I was going to get to last week. Okay, so this is that timeline that we kind of talked through last week. Okay, and this is going to be, because if you look at chapter 7, the first verse says, now on the day that Moses had finished setting up the tabernacle, okay, that should take you all the way back to Exodus 40, right? On the day that Moses finishes setting up the tabernacle, that's Exodus 40. Okay, so this is our timeline to help us keep in mind what's happening. So, and God, remember, God set their calendar, right? So on the first month, on the 14th day of year one, okay, this is Passover when they leave Egypt. Okay. And this is found in Exodus 12, 1 through 2. Ugh. 6 and 31 to 32, if you want to look at the time markers there. Okay. Thank you, sweetie. Okay, then in on the third month, okay, and know that one does not mean January, okay? This is the Hebrew calendar, so this is their first month, okay? So in the third month, on the 14th day of year one, they arrive at Sinai. Okay. So if you think about this, do you remember what happens in here? So this is only 2 months. They're literally traveling to Sinai for 2 months. They grumble a lot. Yes. So we have the Red Sea, and they complain because they have no water and they have no food. Okay? 2 months. Now, granted, if you're running out of food in 2 months, it doesn't matter how short the period of time is, you have no food. Okay? But the point is, it wasn't a very long journey. Okay? And this is in Exodus 19:1. Then the next time marker we get is the first month, the first day of the first month of year two. Okay, and here the tabernacle is set up. And this is Exodus 40, verse 2 and 17. Okay, this is going to be the ordination of the priests. This is Leviticus 8. Now, well, let me just finish and then I'll tell you. Okay, offerings are started. The sacrifices are started. This is Leviticus 1 to 7. Chapters 1 to 7. Okay, the tribal offerings start. This is where we are right now, Numbers 7, 1 to 3. And the cloud covers the tabernacle. And this is Numbers 9:15. Okay. Now, for this one, for these two, if you read these references, there is no time marker. But when you get the rest of the calendar, this is where it has to fall for everything else to work out time-wise. Okay? So as you can see, this day, this is a huge day for Israel. Very important day. Okay, this is the basically the commencement of everything, the priesthood, the sacrifices, right? Everything starting out the worship of God. Okay? Okay, on the first month, the eighth day of the first month of year two. Okay, this is the priest's ordination is complete. And this is in Leviticus 9:1. Okay. Then
sacrifices are started on
day one.
On day one.
Of the
priest ordination complete on.
Okay, because they were to sacrifice for 8 days for the priests.
Okay.
Yeah. On the 12th day of the first month of year two, the tribal offerings are complete. Okay, we're going to do that. That's in Numbers 7. And each tribe brings an offering every day. So they would have been having the ordination of the priests and then offering the sacrifices for the tribes simultaneously. So this is Numbers 7, 78-83. Okay. Then we have Passover, okay? Because it always has to be celebrated on the 14th day over the first month. So this is second Passover celebrated.
So this is the second one, but this is the first, like, celebrated.
Well, kind of. One as released, yes.
This is the
yes.
Yes,
exactly. Not the I have to get out of here version. And this is going to be in Numbers 9. We'll get there 1-3. Then the first day of the second month of year 2, this is the first census, which we have already studied in Numbers. So as you can see, Numbers is not chronological. So this was Numbers 1, 1, and 2. Then on the 14th day of the second month of year 2, I don't know if you remember, Brittany alluded to this last time, this was a second Passover for the unclean. So this would have been if you were unclean on this one, where you were supposed to celebrate it, they say, hey, not fair. We want to celebrate Passover, but we're unclean, so we can't. So God says, fine, you can celebrate it here. You can celebrate it a month later. And this is going to be Numbers 9, 9-11. And then on the 20th day of the second month of year 2, this is, oops. Israel departs Sinai. So they leave. And this is Numbers 10, 11. Okay. Okay. So they are at Sinai for just under a year. They come in the middle of the third month. They leave in the middle of the second month. So 11 months, basically, just over 11 months. They are at Sinai. From the time the tabernacle is set up till when they leave is a month and a half. Okay? Their months, I believe, had 30 days because they were lunar. So a little over a month and a half. Okay? So this, the end, the last month and a half of their time at Sinai is packed. They're setting up their sacrificial system. The priests are getting ordained. The tribes all bring their offerings. They have two Passover celebrations. Granted, the first one was probably way bigger. They had the census. Okay. God gives them all the rules for how they're to march, and then they leave. Okay. Yes. Yes.
How did that work when they were moving? When they were marching, everything was like folded up and in carts and being carried.
I don't know if they would. I don't know. That is a great question. I don't know if they would fold it up every day and set it up when they camped overnight, or if they. I don't know how that worked. Yes, but I would assume that only means when it's set up because they're not going to be burning when it's wrapped up. But yeah, so I don't know if the tabernacle was set up every day, so they would offer sacrifices in the morning, then tear it down, and then set it up and offer sacrifices at night, or if when they were on the move it didn't matter, like they didn't have to do it until, because I think later it says when the cloud rose up, then they would pack up and move, and then when the cloud settled, then they would unpack and be done. So if, you know, they're marching for several days at a time, I don't know exactly how that works. Okay. But when we read, especially Exodus 40 all the way through Numbers, you lose track of time, right? You don't know. So really, Leviticus is probably happening somewhere in here, in this, you know, between when they arrive at Sinai and when the tabernacle is set up so that they know what to do. But also all the laws in Exodus are being, you know, revealed on Sinai there as well. But this last month and a half is packed full of stuff. But you can also see, right, Numbers is also not chronological, right, because it starts out with the census, right? And now here we're going to talk about the tribal offerings all the way in chapter 7. Well, this is happening the same time as Exodus 40. Questions about the calendar? But hopefully, I mean, hopefully this helps make a little more sense. Yeah.
I'm glad I didn't live back then, because I never remember what kind of offering I had.
Well, there are big people to help you. Yeah.
Do you know if they celebrate that first year? I mean, that time when it was the first month. The first day of the first month where they were setting up.
Oh,
today, I
celebrate
if they
that?
Celebrate it as it goes on, just because that's a big deal. That's
that is
big
a big
day.
Deal. I don't know, because Rosh Hashanah, which is the new year, is not then. It's later on. So I don't know. That's a great question.
It's interesting. I wonder why they structured, you know, he structured, God had him structure it this way in Leviticus.
Right.
It's not chronological.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
They could also say, okay, we're taking a quick break, and we're explaining some rules.
Yeah.
When we start back up, we'll be here. Easy to follow.
Okay, can someone read for me? We are not reading this whole chapter, if you've read it. Can someone read for me verse 1 to 11, chapter 7?
Presented them in front of the tabernacle. The Lord said to Moses, accept these from them to be used in the work of the tent of meeting, and give this offering to the Levites, to each division according to their service. So Moses took the carts and the oxen and gave them to the Levites, gave the Gershonites 2 carts and 4 oxen corresponding to their service, and gave the Merarites 4 carts and 8 oxen corresponding to their service, under the direction of Ithamar, son of Aaron the priest. But he did not give any to the Kohathites, since their responsibility service related to the holy objects carried on their shoulders. The leaders also presented the dedication gift for the altar when it was anointed. The leaders presented their offerings in front of the altar. The Lord said to Moses, each day have 1 leader present his offering for the dedication of the altar.
Okay, so Exodus 40 through Numbers 6 describe events from the erection of the tabernacle to the census. Okay, so Exodus 40 starts here. Numbers 6 goes through this first census, okay? Now we're jumping back to day 1, okay? To the first day of the first month. Okay, 7 through 9 record other events that fall in here, right, which is going to be our Passover and the tribal offerings, which happen day 1 to 12 of the first month. Okay, so Moses finishes setting up the tabernacle. He anoints it with oil. All is dedicated to a special service to the Lord. Okay, then we have the first gifts of the tribal leaders, and these are the carts and the oxen, which we talked about in chapters 3 and 4. We jumped ahead to chapter 7. Okay, so they give carts and oxen to help transport the tabernacle. 2 carts and 4 oxen for the Gershonites, and if you remember, they were to transport the curtains. All the curtains except for the veil that separates the holy place from the Holy of Holies. They were responsible for all of their curtains. They would take it down, then they would load it on carts. They did not have to manually carry it. Then four carts, eight oxen were for the Merarites, and they transported the frames, the poles, the sockets, all that stuff. Okay, so there was going to be a lot more of that. And so they get four carts and eight oxen. Again, it emphasizes that the Kohathites, they don't get anything because all the furniture had to be carried manually. It was not to be transported on a cart, which David disobeys. Okay, and people die because of it. What? The Ark of the Covenant, the most important piece of furniture. Yes, and the guy reaches out his hand to stable it, and he dies. Because you don't touch the Ark, ever, for any reason. Okay? All these gifts seem to be spontaneous. We have no record of them being commanded. It doesn't say God said you need to do all this. So the people are responding to God's graciousness and faithfulness. So remember, first 10 chapters of Numbers, Israel's doing great. Okay. All right, questions? First 11 verses, pretty straightforward. Okay, verses 12 to 89. We are not going to read this because it is very repetitive. Every single tribe brings the exact same gift. Okay? And that shows that there's harmony throughout Israel. All the tribes support the tabernacle and the worship of God. Okay? I'll just read the first one because they're all exactly the same. It's verse 12. Now the one who presented his offering on the first day was Nashon, the son of Amminadab, of the tribe of Judah. And his offering was one silver dish, whose weight was 130 shekels, one silver bowl of 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering. One gold pan of 10 shekels full of incense, one bull, one ram, one male lamb, 1 year old, for a burnt offering, one male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, two oxen, five rams, five male goats, five male lambs, 1 year old. This was the offering of Nashon, the son of Amminadab. Verse 18, on the second day, okay, so every day one tribe brings. Okay, so this is what they bring. Where am I going to write this? No. Okay, so can I erase this? Are we done with that? Okay. Okay. So we have okay, so they all bring the exact same thing. So they bring one silver plate, one silver bowl, one gold dish. This was 130 shekels. This was 70 shekels, and this is 10. Okay, this had fine flour and oil. This one had fine flour and oil, and the gold dish had incense in it. Okay, to just give you an idea, this is about 3 pounds. This is about 2 pounds, and this is 4 ounces. Okay. So this fine flour and oil, these were for the grain offerings. So their grain offerings were contained in their dishes, the plates and the bowls. Then the offerings that they had to bring they brought a burnt offering, a sin offering, and a peace offering. Okay, so this would be one bull, one ram, this is for the burnt, and one lamb. And this was 1 year old and male, the lamb. for a sin, they just had to bring one goat, and it was to be male. Then the peace offering, this is where they had to bring all the animals. They had to bring 2 oxen, 5 rams, 5 male goats, and 5 year-old male lambs. Okay, but remember, this is the one they get to eat. Okay, so I'm sure there was some celebration each day for each tribe where maybe the leaders or the men, or I'm not sure who got selected, got to partake in the feast. Okay. So everybody is listed exactly the same way. I mean, the words are the same. Except the tribe and the leader, right? The name. So this emphasizes that every tribe has equal stake in the worship of God. And each tribe, at least at this point, is fully committed to the support of the tabernacle and the priesthood. The order of the tribes is the same order as chapter 2. This is how they camped and how they marched. So Judah is first, okay, because he's going to be the leader. So it's the same order. They bring them in order the same way they camp and the same way they march.
If they kept offering all this animals and stuff, how do they have any animals left? I mean, you know.
Right, I mean, but this is from an entire tribe. This is not from one person.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is an entire tribe of people. Remember, there's about 2.5 million people.
Oh, wow.
Okay, and they all have their flocks. Yeah, yeah.
And this one was just because the tabernacle had been set up.
Yes,
this wasn't continually.
Now, they did have to have a continual supply of lambs because there was a lamb offered every morning and every evening in the temple. Right, but this is excessive because the tabernacle is being dedicated. And this is nothing compared to what Solomon does when the temple is dedicated. I mean, that's ridiculous. But this was from each tribe. Okay, so there would have been a total, you know, everything times 12 of all this. 24 oxen, 60 rams, 60, you know, for all this. But each one is the same.
It's funny that they would take males because they wouldn't reproduce.
Well, right, but it's, so the male is less valuable, actually. Right, I mean, you obviously need the male, but you would need more females because one male can take care of multiple females, and they would be the ones that produce. So by taking the males, you are not harming the population of the animals as much, right? You're still taking a lamb out, but you're not taking the female lamb that can reproduce. Now, sometimes, what did we just, I think it was in the Nazarite, he had to offer a ewe lamb. Okay, so sometimes they did offer the females as well, but here it's very specific that they're to be male.
I understand that the Nazarite vow is a little bit more serious.
Yes.
Granted, this is serious.
Right, right.
The Nazarite vow was something serious, so that's why you took a more serious offering.
Yeah, yeah. Yep.
When they did the offerings of these animals,
yes.
What did they do? Did they eat the body or eat?
Great question. So for the burnt offering, everything is burned to the Lord. All of it. That it's a whole burnt offering. And I think they clean off the feces and whatever, and that gets discarded. But everything is burnt to the Lord. For the sin offering, the priest gets part of it, and the fat is burnt to the Lord. Okay? For the peace offering, the priest gets part of it, and the people who bring the offering get to eat it. So it depended on the type of offering. So the offerings were also a way to feed the priests as well. But the peace offering was one that if you brought, you got to eat part of it as well. So the peace offering shows fellowship with God because the idea is you burn the fat and that's God's portion. So that's like God's portion of the meal. Then the priest gets a portion of the meal and then you eat a portion of the meal. Yeah. The burnt offering, everything of it is God's, and then the sin offering, the fat is God's, and then the priests get part of it too. And that's all in Leviticus. Yeah, no, it wasn't. There was they did use it. Yep, good question. Verse 89, if you skip to all the way to the end of number 7. It says, "Now when Moses went into the tent of meeting to speak with him, he heard the voice speaking to him from above the mercy seat that was on the Ark of the Testimony from between the two cherubim. So he spoke to them." Okay, this is very interesting. Oh, I don't have my timeline up anymore. But if you remember, Exodus 40, what happens? Moses sets up the tabernacle. What happens?
They do it from the inside out.
Yes, they do it from the inside out. But what happens once Moses is all done setting up the tabernacle?
He can't go in.
The glory of God descends on the tabernacle, and not even Moses can go in, right? And we said that was the entire purpose of the book of Leviticus. Moses, the best guy you have, the guy that talks to God face to face, he can't even go in because the glory of God is too great. What do we do? How do we solve this problem? God is to dwell among us, but even our best guy can't approach him. We have a problem. So God sets up the priesthood and God sets up the sacrificial system. So after 12 days of ordination of the priests, the sacrificial system, of the tribes bringing all their gifts, what's the result? Moses can go in and he can talk to God. It says, a voice speaking to him from above the mercy seat. I wonder if Moses was allowed to go back into the Holy of Holies.
And that says, "I will meet you there above the mercy seat."
Yes.
"Are over the Ark of the Testimony. I will speak to you from there about all that I command you regarding the Israelites."
Right. Yeah. So that was God's place of revelation for Moses. So it's just interesting that now at the end of all the gifts, the tribal gifts, so this would be 12 days later, right? It says that now Moses can go in. He can go into the tent of meeting and speak with God again. So this is, go ahead.
You're saying 12 days later, you're actually meaning from Exodus 40.
Yes, so yes, because on the first day of the first month, he sets up the tabernacle, and then 12 days later, the tribal gifts are done, right? Because they bring this every day for 12 days. And then chapter 7 of Numbers concludes with, now Moses can go in, and he can receive more revelation. Okay. Questions, chapter 7. Look how quickly we did 89 verses.
I'll be so proud.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, we'll just do the first four verses of chapter 8 and we'll be done. Can someone read for me the first four verses of chapter 8?
"Now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, 'Speak to Aaron and say to him, when you set up the lamps, the seven lamps shall give light in front of the lampstand.' And Aaron did so. He set up its lamps in front of the lampstand as the Lord commanded Moses. And this was the workmanship of the lampstand, hammered work of gold from its base to its flowers. It was hammered work according to the pattern that the Lord had shown Moses. So he made the lampstand."
Okay, so the question is, why in the world are these verses here?
Did this already, I thought.
Yes, we did. We did. Okay, so why? Okay, so we get the tribal offerings, and then the rest of chapter 8 is going to be the dedication of the Levites, which would make sense, right? Because we talked about the Levites in chapters 3 and 4. This is all the stuff that had to happen in between. Now we're going to dedicate the Levites to the Lord for their service so that on the second month, day 20, they can actually break down the tabernacle and transport it, right? So we got to dedicate them. So why in the world are we talking about the lampstand and Aaron here? Okay. So, I don't have a really great answer, but possibly, okay, so the first 10 chapters of Numbers are preparation to leave, and Israel's doing a great job. The second part is dedicated more to celebration. So, we have the tribal gifts, the dedication of the Levites, and Passover. Okay, these are all kind of celebratory events, right? The tribal gifts are celebrating the tabernacle being set up. The Levites being dedicated to the Lord is a celebration. Then obviously Passover is a celebration. Okay, so this is Aaron's part of the celebration. We, in chapter 7, we have all the heads of the tribes bringing gifts to the Lord, right? In worship to the Lord, all except for the Levites, okay? Because they're the priests and they're the ones that serve the Lord. So they are not included because if you remember, Joseph is now split into two tribes, Ephraim and Manasseh. So even without the Levites, we still have 12, okay?
How did they eat?
Who?
The Levites.
Eat?
Yeah.
In Canaan, they were given cities and then they had the land around the cities to farm. Okay, so here in 8:1-4, we have the head of the tribe of Levi, which is going to be Aaron. Okay, and he is doing his job to enable celebration of worship in the holy place, which is lighting of the lampstand. Okay. And Aaron is kind of a segue from the tribal leaders into the dedication of the Levites. So that's the best answer I got.
Mine says Exodus 25:32-40 recorded the instructions for making of the golden lampstand, and Exodus 37:17 reported its completion here as a part of the dedication of the tabernacle, the seven lamps.
Yes, and that would have been true too, that now that the everything's set up, they would have actually lit the lampstand for the first time. Okay. The emphasis, though, of these verses is specifically the direction of the light. Okay. Verse 2, when you mount the lamps, the seven lamps will give light in the front of the lampstand. God is very specific. How he wants the lamps to shine. Does anyone remember their tabernacle setup? If the lamps shine forward in front of the lampstand, what it is shining upon, do we remember? The table of showbread, okay? Inside the tabernacle, right? This is the Holy of Holies, and so you have your Ark of the Covenant here. You have your altar of incense here, you have your lampstand here, and you have your table of showbread over there. Okay? So if it's shining in front of it, it's going to be shining on the table of showbread. Okay? What is on the table of showbread?
Bread!
Bread! Good job, Abby. How many loaves? Who do they represent? The tribes. Okay? So this is a picture. This is what one of my commentators said. This arrangement portrayed visually God's intention that his people should live continually in his presence and enjoy the blessing mediated by his priests, right? The light of God from the menorah is shining physically on Israel, represented by the 12 loaves of bread. Okay. And it's interesting that only after the tabernacle has been consecrated and the priesthood is installed does God reveal how the menorah was to burn, right? So once we have the priesthood, once we have the sacrificial system set up, now God's light can shine on his people. Now God can be in full relationship with his people, and that is visually pictured by the setup of the tabernacle. Questions? All right, we will finish chapter 8 next week. Keep plugging on through. We're making pretty good progress.